Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. I'll let you in on a little behind-the-scenes drama that we had this morning, which is that we had Harvard professor Annette Gordon-Reed originally booked for Right Now to talk about her new book on Juneteenth, but she had to cancel last minute. Why? Because she was invited to the White House to speak there instead, and that's in conjunction with the establishment of Juneteenth as the newest federal holiday, which was passed by Congress yesterday. So, all right, I guess if she had to choose between the Brian Lehrer Show and the official Juneteenth commemoration at the White House, I don't know, it's close. But we'll give Professor Gordon-Reed a pass on this. Anyway, our loss is the country's gain, and we'll get her back another day to talk about her book. And what we'll do right now instead is we'll go on to a segment that we would have done later in the hour with our in-house legal to talk about Supreme Court cases as the court reaches its end of session, traditionally when the most contentious cases are decided here in the second half of June. And there are a handful of cases we've been following and waiting for. And this morning, this court upheld Obamacare for the third time and rejected a sweeping challenge backed by former President Trump and Republican state attorneys general. Of course, they did strike down parts of Obamacare in the past, but most of it is intact. So we'll talk about that and some other decisions that came down today with Jamie Floyd, WNYC senior editor for Race and Justice and legal editor. Hey, Jamie, thanks for coming on.
Good morning, Brian. I'm honored to be able to stand in for Annette Gordon-Reed, a brilliant woman with a brilliant new book out about Juneteenth.
And as I say, we'll have to reschedule her for a book interview. You don't have to just talk about Juneteenth on the days leading up to Juneteenth. But I heard you did speak to Professor Gordon-Reed earlier this week. Any highlights?
I did, indeed. It was actually a conversation not just about her book. It was a conversation about the symbols of white supremacy and the rise of white nationalism, the Confederate flag. And indeed, we spoke very specifically about incidents in our region, New York, New Jersey. She's quite a brilliant woman. We talked about the history, the long history of white supremacy going all the way back to the earliest days of the Ku Klux Klan and Reconstruction. So, and we did talk about her book a bit, although not as much as perhaps we thought or even that she'd hoped, but it is quite an excellent book and she's a brilliant speaker. So I look forward to hearing her with you, Brian, in the future.
All right. For listeners who might be thinking, wait, Obamacare was in front of the Supreme Court again? What was this case?
That's right, Brian. The Affordable Care Act survived yet another, and I would say a final challenge in the Supreme Court, as we just heard Michael Hill, our colleague, report. In the years since Obamacare was enacted, way back in 2010, Republicans, as we've discussed so many times, Brian, have been working hard to, frankly, destroy it. And President Trump relentlessly criticized it. But all of those attempts to repeal it failed, as did two earlier Supreme Court challenges, 2012 and 2015. We were together for those, Brian.
Yep.
This case was California versus Texas. It was brought by Republican officials who said that the mandate requiring health insurance coverage became unconstitutional after Congress zeroed it out, basically eliminated the penalty that is in the law for failing to obtain coverage because now the mandate could no longer be justified as a tax. But Brian, today the court did not reach that larger issue in the case, whether the bulk of Obamacare could stand without that provision that initially required Americans to obtain insurance or pay the penalty. Instead, Brian, a 7-justice majority ruled that the petitioners had not suffered the sort of direct injury that gave them the standing to sue. No standing, therefore, no suit. Goodbye, lawsuit. And therefore, Obamacare lives to see another day.
Ha, 7-2. Which Republican-appointed justices helped to uphold the Obamacare this time?
Well, let's just talk about the two who did not want to uphold
it. I guess that's easier.
Thomas and Alito, together in dissent. They would have struck it down, and they would have gone further than to say that the plaintiffs had standing. They felt that the provision that is still a tax makes it unconstitutional, that it could not be severed. The main issue was whether or not that tax provision then could be severed, or severability as it's known in constitutional law. And the big question would have been, could that be severed and could the law stand without it? That would have been the big, rather uninteresting constitutional question, but we never got to it because seven said there was no standing.
Right.
And the two dissenters in many cases this term have been Alito and Thomas, and they were in this case. You know, a ruling against the law would have been a huge issue on practical terms. I mean, we've got so many people invested now in Obamacare. It's gained great popularity, as Michael just said in his newscast. It is President Obama's signature legislation. The justices aren't supposed to think about practical and policy and political implications. But one has to think that maybe they do, right?
Before they throw millions of people off their health insurance, at least give that a second thought. All right. And I think Justice Alito, tell me if I got this right, said something like, this is the last book in the trilogy of Obamacare cases.
Well, I would agree with him on that.
So do you think there will be more Obamacare? You don't think there'll be more Obamacare cases in the future? Maybe a movie version or fan fiction,
God,
something?
That sounds so dull. I certainly hope not. I like that he called it a trilogy. It was clever writing, and I do agree this is probably the end of the book on this. I think we can all, I should hope we will all move on to other issues.
And we move on to another case that's been on our list to watch. Jamie and I get together, a little more behind the scenes. Jamie and I and producers get together, usually in May every year, and we go, well, okay, what are the cases that we're expecting to be decided near the end of the term in June that we will stray from regular programming to cover on the mornings they come down? So certainly the Obamacare case was one for this year. Another one is Fulton versus City of Philadelphia. And this is a sort of gay rights versus freedom of religion, quote unquote, case. So
right.
Can you remind listeners of the specifics in that one?
That's right. I agree with the way you frame this one, Brian, and you're also right that we've talked about it behind the scenes because it is yet another in the line of now increasingly familiar cases in our national debate pitting religious liberty claims against LGBTQI rights. And in this one, the city of Philadelphia argued that Catholic social services should be prohibited from continuing to receive city funding while refusing to place foster children with same-sex couples, which the city argued is a violation of Philadelphia's non-discrimination policy. And two Catholic foster parents and Catholic social services claimed in the suit that the city's policy was religious discrimination. So this was a classic tension between LGBTQ rights and religious freedom. And just moments ago, Brian, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Philadelphia was violating the Constitution when its officials excluded Catholic Charities from part of the city's foster care program because the group wouldn't help place the children with the same-sex couples. So this unanimous ruling, Brian, is bolstering the recent line of cases we're seeing in the area of religious freedom guarantees. But, Brian, it didn't go as far as religious rights advocates were hoping. The court said the city infringed on the rights of Catholic social services by enforcing the anti-discrimination requirements in contracts with private agencies that screen potential foster families. But The big takeaway is the case did not go as far as, yet again, Justice Alito would have wanted and Justice Thomas would have wanted. It's not a full-blown religious freedom over everything else kind of case. It was a very careful balancing and limited to this context of contractual relations. And the court and the justices in the majority very plainly said that these families need to be referred to other services, other places where these children can be placed in foster care. So it's a limited decision, but it does strike in favor of religious freedom.
So if I got this right, Catholic Charities in Philadelphia may refuse to consider foster placements in the homes of same-sex couples, but they can be required by the city at least to tell those couples where they can go elsewhere if they're interested in foster families.
That's right. And of course, the city is contracting with Catholic Charities, but also with many, many other foster care placement organizations that does not have this kind of policy. So again, a balancing act by the court. And the court says also a balancing act by the city and by the larger society.
Where would you say this fits into the body of case law on this now? Probably the most famous one that our listeners will, you know, call up in their heads easily was the bakery that wanted to deny baking wedding cakes for same-sex couples. And that went to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So when you take the result of that case and remind us of that and the result of this case, what's the bigger lay of the land now for when, frankly, same-sex couples can be constitutionally discriminated against?
Right. Well, you're exactly right. The court is increasingly striking in favor of religious freedom. And it does, as we said at the beginning of this part of our conversation, very often pit religious liberty claims against LGBTQ rights, or one would say discrimination. And this court, with Thomas and Alito, and one would think Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, the increasingly conservative court now in the majority, is creating a line of cases that favors religious freedom over other freedoms, if you will. And it becomes, you know, and this is in the tradition of Antonin Scalia, who is no longer on the court, but wrote the very famous Peyote case. You'll remember, Brian, the previous, and it's cited, by the way, here throughout both Justice Alito's, by the way, 87-page dissent because he wanted to overturn. He wanted to write a bigger, more impressive, more full-blown religious freedom case here. The Peyote case is the case that really establishes the right to free to practice your religion free of state interference. And, you know, peyote, smoking peyote had been regulated by the state. It was illegal. And the Supreme Court said, no, if you're doing that as a matter of your religious practice, it cannot be regulated by the state. And that's the big, and Scalia wrote that big religious freedom case. And increasingly, the court is pushing in favor of more and more religious freedom. And Alito wants to say that case wasn't enough. We need more. Complete free exercise with no state intervention at all. But here, Brian, is the big takeaway I saw today. Amy Coney Barrett, who one would think would be with Alito, and Thomas, the more conservatives on religious freedom. That's what we thought about, talked about, heard about during her confirmation hearing.
Right. She came from this very conservative Christian sect.
Exactly. She wrote a concurrence saying, directly disagreeing with Alito, saying the court should not in this case reinterpret or perhaps overturn the Peyote case, the free exercise case. She does not think it is right in this case, and she is not, she says, likely to think it ever to be a case to be reinterpreted in a larger, more expansive way.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So I don't know where they're going, basically. I mean, I see where they've been, and they are little by little ticking forward in the religious freedom expansion. But I don't know that we're going to see a full-blown, I don't know that Alito and Thomas have the votes to create the kind of sort of Warren-esque. Let me explain what I'm talking about. The Warren Court being the most, in my mind, the most powerful Supreme Court we've ever had, with Earl Warren as Chief Justice and a very, very solid majority to really establish a line of cases that protected civil rights and civil liberties. Brown versus Board, Loving versus Virginia. I mean, I could name the list of cases and it would take the rest of the time we have together.
Yeah.
And I don't think Justice Roberts has that power on the court, nor do I think he shares the philosophy of Justice Alito and Justice Thomas. I don't think they're all together, Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett, in thinking, in philosophy, in intent. I'm not behind the scenes. I don't know for sure. But the sense that I get is that we're not going to have a Roberts Court that mirrors something like the Warren Court, mm-hmm, or the earliest days of the U.S. Supreme Court at the very beginning of its inception. We've only had one or two powerful courts like that. I don't see that happening here.
But before we move on to some other cases, how far could a group or an individual go now if they want to discriminate against some other group? These seem to be built particularly on the constitutional equal protection of LGBTQ people versus the constitutional protections for expression of religious liberty,
right,
on the part of the bakery in Colorado that didn't want to, you know, serve that wedding, and now Catholic Charities in Philadelphia, which doesn't want to place foster kids in those homes. Mm-hmm. Let's say Catholic Charities or that bakery said, well, it because of our religious beliefs, we don't want to serve Jews. They're not. They don't believe what's consistent with our belief.
Right.
We don't want to serve Black people if they decided to take that stance for whatever reason.
We've had those cases. Those are the cases from the 1960s. So famous barbecue case. We talked about it on More Perfect, the podcast we had about the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yep.
So there are different levels of scrutiny for different behaviors. And it was talked about in this case today, in the Fulton case. When religious freedom is at issue, strict scrutiny is applied. When the state, so we always have to remember, when we're talking about constitutional issues, the question is, what is the state doing? It's not about the individual. So I always say to my kids will say, I think I said this to you the last time we spoke, Brian, my kids will say, I have the right to speak in this house. And I say, well, actually, you don't. You don't have the right to speak. The First Amendment is about the state infringing your First Amendment rights, your right to speak.
Right.
It's not about your parent or even a private, you know, if you work for a law firm and they tell you you can't say something, they can pretty much tell you that. It's about the state shall not infringe your right to speak. The state shall not infringe religious freedom. So that's the first question. Is it a state infringement? That's why we have distinctions between what public schools do and what private schools do. They're two different things when it comes to constitutional analysis. So to get to your question, Brian, I had to lay all that out, because the first question the court asks is, who is the actor? Who is the actor? And then the second question is, who is complaining and do they have standing? And then, depending on the actor, we have to apply a certain analysis. If someone is complaining about religious discrimination, the question is whether or not the state is infringing upon your religious freedom. And if you are LGBTQ, or if you are a woman, or if you are African American or Native American, there are all different levels of scrutiny depending on your status in our country under the Constitution. Now, we could do a whole hour on this, Brian, so I can't, but believe it or not, different levels of scrutiny apply depending on who you are. And the highest scrutiny is based on race. Mm. That's the strict scrutiny. Why? Because of our legacy with slavery. 13th mm-hmm. Amendment, 14th Amendment, and 15th Amendment. They're not about these other things. I mean, I'm a woman. I care about being a woman. But those three amendments have nothing to do with gender. They have to do with race and our ugly history with race, which we all know we are still grappling with.
Yes,
and that is the strictest scrutiny, the strictest discrimination that we care about the most constitutionally. The rest of it... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. No, no.
Well, and we do care very much about, obviously, religious freedom. That's the First Amendment. The rest of it has been largely interpreted into the Constitution by the justices over the years. Things like the right to choose to have an abortion. That's nowhere in the Constitution. That's constitutional interpretation. And things like age discrimination. Gender came later, as we all know. Later in the constitutional amendments. So this is why I love constitutional law. I could talk about it forever.
And I could listen to you.
But it is really complicated. Yes. And so that's why this balancing, and this is why our society is so richly diverse. And I love our city. I love our country because of its diversity. But balancing all of these interests, because they do compete, is so critically important, because we all have to get along in our beautiful fabric of a rich, diverse society. How do we get along? I believe we have to have laws. We have to have a constitutionally fair society where everybody, gets a chance to live a fully actualized life.
And it wasn't that long ago, in political terms, that Congressman Ron Paul, father of Rand Paul, was running for president, having had earlier in his life opposed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, mm-hmm. that bedrock Civil Rights Act, on the libertarian grounds that the government shouldn't tell private businesses
right.
what they have to do, including who they have to serve, even based on race. I want right. to move on. And if you're just joining us, listeners, we have a few minutes left with our legal editor, Jamie Floyd, on some Supreme Court decisions that have come down this week. And I want to touch briefly on a few rulings that came down having to do with sentencing. First, on Monday, the court ruled that some crack cocaine offenders sentenced to years in prison cannot get their sentences reduced
right.
under the recent First Step Act. Clarence Thomas wrote that majority opinion.
Right.
Wasn't the First Step Act written to do just that, to revise the overly harsh sentences that we now think are wrong for nonviolent drug crimes?
That's right. And this is a really technical decision. And in the end, the court ruled unanimously, Brian, that the way in which the law was written means that it does not require new sentences for some low-level drug offenders. What's really interesting, Brian, anyone who has any interest in reading this set of opinions, I know it's a lot to read a U.S. Supreme Court opinion, but it's really a fascinating debate between Justice Thomas and Justice Sotomayor, who in the end signed the opinion. Because when you're a justice, you have to read the law and apply the law. And the way the First Step Act is written, it does not require new sentences for this man who came to the court asking for one. But in the end, the reason it's interesting to read it, Brian, is that even though they all agree that looking at the letter of the law, this man does not get a new sentence, they are sharply divided about sort of the history of sentencing law. And they go all the way back to 1986, the law that subjected drug dealers selling crack cocaine to the same sentences as people selling 100 times as much powder cocaine. And Justice Thomas writes about the 1986 law, and he talks about how it had overwhelming bipartisan support, including from the Congressional Black Caucus. And this man, Tariq Terry, was convicted and pleaded guilty to the intent to distribute 4 grams of crack. Justice Sotomayor writes in her concurrence that this is, quote, less than the weight of 4 paper clips. Hmm. But he is then sent to prison because he's a career offender, right? 3 strikes, and sentenced to 15 years. So he asked to be resentenced under the First Step Act. And, you know, Justice Thomas writes a very, you know, accurate and thoughtful opinion. Quote, many black leaders in that era professed two concerns, he writes. First, crack was fueling crime against residents in inner cities who were predominantly black. And he notes that the NAACP chapter in Washington called crack, quote, the worst thing to hit us since slavery. But then Justice Sotomayor responds, Brian, in her concurrence, the court barely references the real world impact of the sentencing disparities between crack and powder cocaine. Black people bore the brunt of this disparity. 80 to 90% of those convicted of crack offenses between 92 and 2006 were black, while black people made up only 30% of powder cocaine offenders in those same years. Brian, the reason I'm saying black the way I am, Justice Sotomayor capitalizes black throughout her entire opinion just to emphasize to Justice Thomas how she feels he completely misreads this history. So it's a really fascinating opinion in the end. But Mr. Terry does not get his sentence reduced, even though, by the way, this took so long to wind its way through the courts. He's about to get out anyway.
Isn't that standard writing, though, by the way? I think, in the New York Times and just about everywhere, I think standard English now is to capitalize the word black when you're talking about black people, as you would capitalize Jewish or other ethnic groups, let's say.
Yes, there's a big debate about it, honestly, Brian. We capitalize it at New York Public Radio. It is in our style guide to capitalize black. The New York Times capitalizes black, and they did an editorial about why. Justice Sotomayor capitalized throughout. Justice Thomas did not. But there are some prominent African-American scholars who do not feel we should be capitalizing black. Howard Bryant has written quite a bit about why he feels we should not capitalize black. So it's not a settled point, but it is rather ironic, is it not, that the black Supreme Court justice did not capitalize black, and Sotomayor, who is not black but is Afro-Latina, chose to.
There you go. All right. Before we run out of time, one other case about sentencing that was decided last week. The court ruled that violent felonies committed recklessly as opposed to intentionally do not count as strikes under the Armed Career Criminal Act. That law requires mandatory 15-year sentences for people of convicted of possessing firearms if they have earlier been found guilty of three violent felonies, one of those three strikes and your outlaws. Mm-hmm. We see this in all kinds of laws. So as we start to run out of time, Jamie, maybe you can frame the difference under the law between reckless and intentional.
Right. This is pretty straightforward, Brian. As you say, the Federal Armed Career Criminal Act is what the case was about. It is essentially a three strikes statute. And the case was just about what is a strike and what is not a strike. And they said that if you commit a crime recklessly, as opposed to intentionally or knowingly, that's not a strike. That doesn't count as a strike. You have to do three intentional crimes for it to be a strike. So you're right, Brian, there is a big difference in the law between intentional acts and reckless acts. And when you go to law school, happiest years of my life, I will say, the first thing you learn, you learn two Latin phrases, actus reus and mens rea. And the act is the actus rea, and the mens rea is the intention, the state of mind. What were you thinking? Did you mean to do it, or was it just something you did recklessly? If you drive your car intentionally into a crowd, that's one kind of crime. But if you just recklessly drive your car and you happen to roll into a crowd, that's something else. It could still be a crime. It could be an accident. It could be a crime. But if it's lacking in intent, it's not going to be first-degree murder, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this case is about. It's not fair to call it a strike for three purposes in federal law if you didn't intend to do it. And in criminal law, intent is everything. You know, we see it in every case.
What are we still waiting for from the court before the end of the month, Jamie? We have 20 seconds.
Oh, well, we have a couple of big cases coming down, and we have a couple of big cases in the next term as well. You know, they took Tsarnaev. They have affirmative action. We have a big gun case in New York State. So we'll be talking about a lot of stuff, Brian.
And at least one more time, I have a feeling, before the end of June and the final Supreme Court decisions for this term. WNYC Senior Editor for Race and Justice and our legal editor, Jamie Floyd. Jamie, thanks.
Thank you, Brian.